Is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
And we're going to continue discussing with Jonathan Gray the fascinating, fascinating story of ancient technologies and just what happened to all of it. Back in a moment. Jonathan, you also supplied us with an ancient map. Tell us a little bit about this one.
Oh, yes. This map was found in the Ural Mountain area of Russia. There were reports of these strange stones up in a certain village up in the north, and scientists from Moscow University went up there, and apparently there were several hundred of these. Seven were taken down to Moscow and examined, and they identified them as aerial type maps of large areas of that northern part of the continent. A huge water dam, a huge reservoir dam, and a canyon, roads going across, and so on. In other words, these maps are large-scale maps of large areas, as though taken from the air, but the interesting thing is that they're three-dimensional, and I believe the American Air Force is only now beginning to get into this kind of mapping of three dimension, and it hasn't perfected it quite yet. So here we have something very advanced going back quite a few thousand years.
How accurate are they?
As accurate as can be determined, that they would have had to have been done from the air and not from the ground.
Now, what does that tell you? That we had flying machines or that extraterrestrials came here and basically helped draw a map for us?
Well, there seems to be evidence that man did have the knowledge and the theoretical knowledge as well as the ability to fly in the past.
Do you think, Jonathan, it's possible that we were so advanced that we had rocket ships, that we went to the moon? Maybe our astronauts saw some of these ancient artifacts there. They don't want to say anything to us.
Well, George, the first flight to the moon in which Neil Armstrong walked on the moon...
1969.
1969. I remember exactly where I was. I was walking down Hay Street in Perth in Western Australia when I heard the news, and I was listening to it on my radio. And the news was given at that time from... the name of the guy who was orbiting the moon, I can't remember his name.
Well, that was Michael Collins, I think.
Michael Collins, fine. He was giving a live report back to NASA, and 11 minutes of that report was cut out of all later broadcasts, but that 11 minutes was explosive. I mean, he was talking for hours, but 11 minutes were cut out. And you know what he was talking about in those 11 minutes?
I think you're going to tell us.
He was reporting what appeared to him to be pagoda-type buildings on the moon.
As he circled the moon with Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin on the moon, he was reporting back to NASA that he was seeing structures of buildings on the moon. Is that what you're saying?
That is correct. And he reminded me of something I'd been researching, actually, in my very earliest explorations, because I only started exploring the Amazon just before that. And one of the first things that came to my notice was that the Chinese were talking about flying. And this was one of the things I was pushing out of my mind, because to me it just sounded like nonsense. it just sounded like fiction. But the more you go into this and find out the history of Chinese thinking and literature, the more evident it is the Chinese knew a lot. Now, there was an emperor of China who made it a law to punish by death any man who wrote fiction. In other words, if it wasn't true history, he was not allowed to live. Now, in the historical writings of China, many of which have now been translated into English since the Nixon cultural exchange took place, there are records of emperors sending astronauts to the moon. And they describe the moon in these ancient works going back 2,000 or 3,000 years. They describe it as glassy-like, exactly as our present astronauts have. They describe it as being cold, and they describe the Earth as seen from the moon. They describe things precisely as our own astronauts have described them, and which we would not have known had we not sent astronauts there. And one thing they did describe is that they built a structure which they called the Palace of Cold because of the temperature. Now, I don't know what Colin saw when he was looking down, but I like to piece things together, and maybe I am entering into speculation, but the Chinese, so they built something on the moon. Colin said he saw something on the moon. I'm just wondering if he saw what they built.
And here they are wanting to go back to the moon again some thousands of years later.
Yes.
Well, I got to tell you, it's an incredible story if that indeed happened that way. But I have always suspected that they saw something, and they were so shocked. Some have, again, speculated that Armstrong might have seen some UFOs, and he didn't want to. He just couldn't talk about it when he came back, and therefore he clammed up all these years. But I always wondered what would happen if they had gotten there, taken a look at some of these things, saw these structures, maybe saw even some ships or what was left of ships, craft. And I bet somewhere along the line, Jonathan, they have some incredible pictures.
Oh, yes, I'm sure there are, but we're not being shown them.
So at least you believe we went to the moon in 1969, as I do.
I certainly do. I think we had the technology to do it, and it seems that they must have had some technology like that. Otherwise, how could they have described it so perfectly?
So they were able to map three-dimensionally part of the planet. They obviously did it from above somehow. What do you think? Well, if we've been to the moon, obviously we had sophisticated crap, but what do you think the planes look like? Because there have been, and you provided that too, sketches of what look like modern day airplanes.
Well, yes, there have been models found in Egypt and also in three Central American countries. In tombs from the past, going back thousands of years, which have been tested aerodynamically. In Saqqara, there were found, I think it was 14 models, and they gathered dust in a Cairo museum for many years, and then they were brought out and tested by aeronautical experts, and they took models of what they found, made replicas of them, and they flew. They were able to fly them. They glided perfectly, and so they were made with knowledge of aerodynamics, and these were going back 2,000 or 3,000 years in Egypt. We have similar models, but made of metal, in tombs from Colombia and other places, and these also have been tested by American military experts who say that these are not models of birds or flying fish, they're models of aircraft. They have cockpits in them. They have all sorts of things that today we use, but birds don't have.
Something big happened. Something major happened. What do you believe then kicked up so much dirt to bury these objects thousands and thousands of feet deep below the planet?
Well, if this disaster was a global, it would certainly be intercontinental and seas and land would be churned up together, George. What we've got evidence of here on hundreds of thousands of hilltops, perhaps I could mention this, is that there are mass burial graves on every continent. There's not one continent that doesn't have these, and they're on hilltops and mountaintops. where you have thousands of animals and trees and sea creatures all buried and mixed up together, their bones all in a mass and concreted over by natural concretion processes.
Mm-hmm.
And these are being found, not just a few hundred mountains, hundreds of thousands have been found worldwide. And they show that somewhere, somebody was fleeing from a disaster. Animals were fleeing, but how did the whales and the sharks get mixed up with them? In other words, there was land and sea all being churned up together, and they were buried and cemented together eventually.
Can you imagine what the sound might have been of this planet being churned around the way it was? I mean, it must have been deafening.
Oh, it must have been. And water travels, and the sound travels so much louder through water.
The people who must have gone through this, you talk about frightening.
Yeah, they must have been going through a nightmare. And when they came out of it, there was a great fear of it. We have legends. We can go back to our ancient recorded history of our ancestors, and on all races there's a memory of an event that had such a tremendous impact on them that they had fear in their stories that they recorded, as though they had personally been survivors. With that, stories were told with such awe-struck impressiveness. Now, we go to geology and we find physical evidence that something did happen, and it was global. And in India, you have 10,000 feet of water-laid sediment, and there's no rivers that could have brought them. This is all high stuff. And there's no natural process today that can make sediment like that. There's no natural process that can make coal fields that are thousands of feet deep today.
With people's body parts in them.
Yes, and with the bits of machinery and pots and jewelry and so on all mixed up with people, yes.
That's something. You talked last hour about the Andes Mountains and about a ship. Why don't you elaborate a little bit more about that?
Oh, yes. The Andes Mountains, for a start, are fairly young by the legends of the people in South America. They say they came up in a day and a night, and I would say that this could have happened because there was a great readjustment of the Earth's surface for hundreds of years after the Great Flood. And there was time for migration to take place and for cities and towns and villages to be built. And the convulsions continued for some time. Now, there's a city up near Lake Titicaca. And Titicaca is an interesting place. That's where the floating islands are, where the people live on these grass islands that float around, and the wind blows them around. They've got glass houses and grass boats and so on.
Yeah.
And the boats are very similar to those in the ancient Egyptians used to have, grass boats. Now, 12 miles south of Lake Titicaca, and by the way, Lake Titicaca is a beautiful lake. It's got a massive flamingos. You can look out from the shore of the lake and see all this pink amongst the blue, and it's all these beautiful, long, necked flamingos all together there. Beautiful. But anyway, south of there, 12 miles, there is the remains of a city. The name it's given today is Tiwanaku. That may not have been its original name, but that's what we identify it by today. That city is in ruins. Much of it was destroyed by the Spaniards, for building the railroad and other things when they took over. But prior to that, there were many beautiful statues and lovely buildings and gates, but they were in ruins. Now, to the south, not facing Lake Titicaca, but to the south, away from the lake, there are huge ship quays where big ships used to come in and dock. And the iron circles for them to tie in and thread their ropes around to keep the ship close are still there. Now, the native people who live a little further inland say that in a day and a night, the whole Andes Mountains rose from sea level. Here you've got a seaport 12,000 miles above sea level today, which was probably right on the Pacific coast at the time. And behind that, you've got still some mountains, and you've got a shoreline a sandy shoreline with seaweed and seashells still looking fairly fresh at a level of 12,200 feet.
Oh my.
So something happened there.
It's something dramatic to move ships, to embed them in mountainsides, to find people thousands of feet, but remains of people thousands of feet down. It really is. It's shocking to imagine what could have occurred during that period.
Yes, and this is in historical times, George. We're not talking about millions of years here. These things are fresh. And we've got the memory of it in the minds of tribes that still survive in the area.
Jonathan, does the Bible echo any of this?
The Bible does give us a very interesting account of the Great Flood and gives a log, actually, a day-by-day log of events, as though somebody was keeping a ship's log when they were surviving this, waiting to get out. After so many days this happened, then after so many days they did this, and so on, while they were inside it. So that's an interesting story.
So you believe that the great flood that's illustrated in the Bible, that might have occurred during this catastrophe?
I believe it could have been the same catastrophe.
Oh, that's great. That is a fascinating story, too, all by itself. And it also tells you a little bit about some of the humans that were saved, Noah and his family. And though it may have been symbols, too. It may have been a real event with symbols of the ark. Is that possible?
Well, the symbols actually are probably based upon real events. Yeah, symbols. There were certainly symbols. But when you go down to Turkey today, you'll notice that the Turkish government has declared an area a historical park, and they call it the Noah's Ark Park. The interesting thing about that region is that, archaeologists as a whole tend to put a lot of weight upon place names. Now, in America, I know over here in New Zealand we do this, a place name sticks from a historical event, and in America you do the same, don't you?
Oh, sure do, yep.
And in Turkey, in this whole area, there's it's a place called the Place of Eight, which reflects back on the eight human survivors in the Noah's survival vessel. Then you've got a place called Where the Crow Cannot Land, reflecting back to the biblical story of the crow that was sent out to see how much land was now reappearing above the water, and it couldn't find a place, so it flew back. And you've got a village saying this is the place where it happened. Then you've got another mountain just close by there, which says this is where the boat flowed over. In other words, the mountain's named after the flowing over of the boat. Then you've got another place name which says here is where one of the anchor stones was dropped. And it's interesting that there's a lot of ancient, going back thousands of years, folklore in that region about the landing of the big boat up in the mountains.
How many people do you think were on the planet at this time, 5,000 years ago?
Possibly in the billions. I would think there would have to be. We're finding evidence of human remains worldwide, deep under, so it probably might have even been similar to our population, George. Who can tell? But I'd say it was a pretty sophisticated and well-developed civilization. There must have been a lot of people.
Cremo talked about these small metallic spheres, hundreds of them, that were found deep, deep within the planet, too.
Yes, down in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many interesting things being found. Down in Europe, quite a number of things, too. Pieces of machinery have been found underground, way down underneath the coal.
Have you sent our webmaster this picture yet of this machine you were talking about?
No, I haven't, because I'm nowhere near the computer, I'm sorry, but I will do it straight after the broadcast.
Okay. If you can't, how much time do you need to do it? Could you do it in 3 minutes or something like that?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Well, why don't
you want me to do it during one of the breaks?
Yeah, well, you could do that at the top of the coming hour. Not this break that's coming up in a minute, but right at the top of the hour, you will have about a 5-minute time period to send it to Lex and then rush back to your phone so you don't miss the rest of the interview. Want to do that?
Okay, I'll do that.
Okay, and we'll have him posted. I am curious about this piece of machinery that you said was found on a military installation. Is there a story around that found?
There is a story, and if I can pick up the story, I'll send that along with it.
Okay, we'll do that. And when we come back, We'll continue this hour our discussion with Jonathan Gray. His website is called archaeologyanswers.com. That's very easy to remember, archaeologyanswers.com. His book is called Dead Men's Secrets. We'll be back in a moment. At the top of the hour, we'll open up the phone lines on Coast to Coast AM.
Podcasting, the new way to get Coast to Coast AM to your computer. Available to all StreamLink subscribers at coasttocoastam.com.
Children drunk lemonade, and the morning lasted all day, all day. And through an open window came, like Sinatra in a younger day, pushing the town away.
From somewhere deep below the earth, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie on Premier Radio Networks.
You know, what's also fascinating, ancient texts talk about a major war, as we were talking about, some kind of calamity that occurred on this planet thousands of years ago. I've always believed, always, that we had once an advanced civilization on this planet worldwide, and that something horrible happened. And just talking with Jonathan Gray, you know, it just confirms that. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Jonathan Gray. Jonathan, is there any evidence that shows or proves that the calamity that you say occurred 5,000 years ago, that it might have been ongoing, that maybe we had one 50,000 years ago, a million years ago, or do you think this one was just a one-time event?
My own personal view is it's just a one-time event, George. But we do have a good evidence for it, very good evidence. And I think that if we focus on that evidence, we've got an explanation of everything we've had happening since.
Let's talk a little bit more about that evidence. Some of the things that you say back us up in terms of this theory. What might it be?
Well, what we have here is an interesting time synchronization of the physical features of the Earth. If we go, for example, to waterfalls and coral reefs and so on, we find a very similar age being confirmed for these. Would you like me to go into some of those?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Sure. Thank you.
Okay. We've got, for example, Inland seas, they're gradually shrinking. They've been shrinking for the last 4,000 or 5,000 years. Even in our lifetime, the Caspian Sea and the Aral Sea and others have been measured in their shrinking. They've retreated several miles. Studies of salt and mineral deposits in numerous such lakes suggest that none of them is older than about 4,000 years. Now, river deltas, the Mississippi. Now, the Mississippi's got 80,000 tons of rubbish an hour coming down. I shouldn't say rubbish. 80,000 tons of silt and so on coming down an hour.
Sludge, as we call it.
Sludge. And the Nile, the Volga, all the great rivers of the world, they all show evidence that they're not older. These deltas are not older than about 5,000 years old if you take them back. You go to Niagara Falls, the waterfalls of the world, and the present channel that's been cut into the falls by the water has been measured and said to be less than 4,500 years old. We come down to Australia, the Great Barrier Reef. And by the way, coral, George, grows like tree rings. It's building up all the time, and it can be measured.
Yeah, it's a barometer of time, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And the average growth at half an inch a year makes the Great Barrier Reef 4,330 years old. Now, trees, the oldest trees that can be confirmed for age are between 4,000 and 5,000 years old. And I know that something a little older than that has been speculated for bristle cone pines, but you have to synchronize all the trees and find that they are around about the same age. Sometimes in 1 year, you'll get up to 5 rings on one tree. That's not generally known. Or even if a tree is growing on the side of a hill, on one side, it might have 2 rings grow the 1 year and 1 ring the next. It depends upon climatic conditions and the interchange of dry and hot during the same year even. But generally speaking, in stable conditions, it's usually 1 ring a year.
Jonathan, do some mainline scientists talk about this? Are they puzzled that it looks like everything is directly channeled to 4,000 to 5,000 years ago, or do they just pass on that?
Well, a lot of scientists are not aware of the pattern. I'm a pattern man because it started with my technology discoveries that True. There was a pattern worldwide, but there was a certain resemblance between all of the technology in every continent. So I started looking at it as relating to the disaster that wiped out civilization, and I found there's a pattern here too. Most scientists specialize in deserts or trees or coral reefs, but they don't look at the pattern overall. But it's when you bring the pattern together, you begin to see something interesting. The Potsdam Institute for Climate Research in 1999 came to the conclusion that the oldest desert in the world is only 4,000 years old. Now, you don't get a desert underneath a flood, underneath water. It's only when the water goes away the desert starts growing.
That's right.
And a very interesting thing occurred. By the way, glaciers, ice, and so on. The Rhone Glacier has been measured at 4,875 years. All the European Alps have lost half their ice in the past 100 years, so ice doesn't have to be tens of thousands of years old. The ice of Greenland is an interesting one. A friend of mine was talking to a guy who salvaged some planes that were left there after Second World War. They were called the Lost Squadron. And maybe some of the listeners are familiar with this story.
But I remember this, yeah. Go ahead again, though.
Yeah. You see, by looking at all the rings in the ice in Greenland and Antarctica, there are about 30,000 rings in Greenland, for example. You would guess from that that the ice had been there 30,000 years, but not so. It's been speculated, and this is in scientific journals, that the ice is like a tree ring. You have summer and winter, and so it builds up, and you've got 30,000 years of ice. Now, the man who recovered one of these planes from Greenland, he said that his team went up there in recent years to retrieve these planes and found that they were 186 feet under the ice. And my friend spoke to him and said, now, did you notice any rings in the ice as you went down? He said, yes, we did. There are thousands and thousands of those rings.
Thousands, that's amazing.
But my friend said, but wait a minute, aren't those annual rings? He says, no, not on your life. They're not annual rings. You can get several rings in a week. It's just the change, a warmer period, a colder period, and the ice builds up constantly because it's always blowing. So 30,000 rings does not mean 30,000 years. And 186 feet down had thousands of rings in just, what, 50 years, 60 years? So we can't go by rings to make glaciers, but the Rhone Glacier and all the glaciers of the world are no older than 5,000 years, according to the latest research.
And whatever it was, it must have been so big because it's all around the planet.
Yes, so big. Now, a gentleman by the name of Dr. George Dodwell, he was the Astronomer Royal in Adelaide, Australia, and he did research into the observations of the planets and their moons over the last 3,000 years, and he discovered that the observations, which were very accurately made in China, Europe, Middle East, and so on over this period, all agreed that the Earth was spinning like a top and that it was adjusting itself from a disruption that occurred violently at a certain date. And he plotted this on a curve and sent his results to other scientists who were able to confirm that his calculations were correct. And he said something tipped the Earth on its axis in the year 2345 BC. His name is Dr. George Dodwell. So he gave a date, a scientific date for it.
He said 2345 BC or 1000 BC?
2345 BC, which is about, what, 4,500 years ago.
2345. Oh, 2345. 2345. Okay.
Yeah,
I see
that's
what
right.
You mean. Okay, I thought you were saying 2345. No.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, it's remarkable. I mean, everybody seems to have the same date.
Well, it's coming from all types of clocks, as you might say. Something big happened between 4,000 and 5,000 years ago. It was a global thing that happened.
Well, let's hope that never happens again.
Yeah.
Are you aware of some rocks in Peru that show ancient technology carved on them? They've got like surgeries, machines. They're called ICA rocks, ICA. And there's no way anybody did that now as a joke. I mean, these things are thousands of years old.
Yes, I certainly I haven't seen them personally, George, but I'm familiar with them. I've seen photographs of a number of them and the stories behind them. And I believe that these show evidence of being genuine. And yes, there was too many of them just to be hoaxes. Who would go to the trouble of wasting his whole life just doing that for nothing?
Explain a little bit more now for us, Jonathan, now that we've got a clear picture of what might have happened. How we got the survivors and how many you think there might have been?
Well, if we go to ancient records, the Aborigines say there was one group of survivors, so do certain tribes of American Indians, and so do various other cultures. That's one thing they have in common, that there was one group of survivors. Now, I'm not going to contradict what our ancestors are handing down to us because they live closer to the events, and I know a lot of people would say, but there must have been lots of different survival vessels.
Right.
Well, my question is, can we be sure of that? Or should we rather go with what we're being told by our ancestors who live near the event?
I would tend to listen to the ancestors, wouldn't you?
They tend to be closer, and they tend to know more than we do often.
True.
Now, the Bible also says there was one group of survivors. And if you're talking about a survival vessel, this is something that I've got into more recently and found to be extremely fascinating, that many modern shipbuilders have gone to the book of Genesis to study the remains of that survival vessel that old Noah was in.
Based on the specifications.
And based on that specifications, they've given us the types of boats we have today that are the best for the worst conditions at sea. Well, it looks like we've got to lift that ark out of the realm of a fanciful tale into the realm of a accurate scientific report. We've got dimensions there that stand up scientifically better than any dimensions in the past. So it looks like we're having eyewitnesses here who are writing that story.
And it doesn't sink.
Doesn't sink. It would roll, the waves would roll over it, but it was built to withstand the worst of storms and to survive it.
How much knowledge do you think we lost, Jonathan, when this happened?
Most of it, I think, George. What was left was probably just an echo of what used to be. I don't know how. Suppose our civilization was destroyed now, and there was a group of survivors. They wouldn't take on board one fraction of what's available in our world today. They'd have to start from scratch at a much lower level, even if it was sophisticated. And I believe this is what we look at when we see Egypt and Samaria and so on.
Do you believe, Jonathan, that we had this one major catastrophe that wiped out this high technology civilization around this planet? Or might we have had several others before that and something happened to them too?
Well, you know, it's interesting to speculate, but once again, I have to go to the evidence, and I'm not going to dispute one way or another as to what might have happened, but I do know that this one did happen, and it was so widespread, it just destroyed so much and left its evidence for us to study.
I very, very would like to hear your thoughts on what you think occurred.
Well, perhaps I'll try to describe this event as I see it, perhaps. As far as the physical events, I would like to do it that way, if I might.
Okay, and let's assume some people are on the planet when this is occurring.
Yeah.
What are they doing? What's happening to them?
Well, you'll have people doing business deals in the big cities. And possibly on the TV news, there's stories of these warnings about what's coming, and people dismiss it like they do today. You go to Mount St. Helens, and a lovely gentleman was about 20 miles away from the mountain, and the reports kept coming that the mountain was about to blow up, and he says, "I'm sitting here, I've lived here all my life, and nothing's happened." And he's now under the ash.
Deep.
Yeah, deep. And probably happened with these people. And there were children at school, and probably when the event began, the headmaster called all the teachers together, the teachers called the children together, says, "Go home and be with your parents. We don't know what's going to happen." And that's the last day that school ever existed again. We're dealing with human lives here that were affected and that never survived it. But what actually are we seeing? We're seeing an external force that tipped the Earth on its axis, changed the climate in a flash, reversed the land and water ratio, so it's now more water than land, virtually wiped out the world's population, and we're inhabiting a world that is damaged and impoverished with deserts and ice and still suffering the effects of some great disaster.
And buried it by thousands of feet, right?
Buried it, yeah. Now, here's my scenario. This would have generated, this force coming close to the Earth would have generated high-speed ultra-vibrations, I believe, within the crust of the Earth. And the finely tuned balance was suddenly disrupted. And under the Earth, we've got fire and we've got water basins, enormous ones. And these were suddenly broken up, and the pressure underneath became enormous as the cracks came into the crust. And the huge granite crust exploded. Jets of water possibly shooting 70 miles or 100 miles into the canopy, and the canopy beginning to collapse as water in a disastrous rain. Water coming from under the ground, water coming from above, the atmosphere.
And the sky must have been blocked out the sun for years.
Oh, yes, it must have been. And there's evidence that the Earth's crust has been violently scoured several miles deep, and water-laid sediment filling up those scours. Evidence that animals and people were fleeing together to great heights and that they were trapped. It certainly was not the survival of the fittest, George. You've got young and old, fit and unfit, all mixed up together, thousands of feet up, washed into crevices with debris washed over them, land and sea creatures mixed together. You'll see this in France, Gibraltar, Lebanon, North America, South America, Australia, China, India, Africa. It's a global phenomenon, all driven together, all smashed to pieces.
Did it happen in one day?
It probably took weeks.
Weeks, okay.
As it kept rising and rising, and new every new day, probably the waves would be coming higher and higher through the continents. But a mass extinction in all parts of the world, sudden burial. Oh, let me tell you about this one, a whale on its tail. This one sort of tickles me a bit.
And you know, they just found a whale skeleton in the desert, in Egypt.
In Egypt. Well, look at that. It's land, but the sea was over there.
Yeah.
Up there, now what's the name of this place? Lompoc. It's a little town northwest of Los Angeles, close to the coast, but it's mountainous there. And there's a quarry been going there for a few years. They've been quarrying the, what do they call them, little sea creatures that just about comprise the whole mountain. Diatoms, I think, aren't they? Diatoms, yeah.
Oh, yes, yeah, yeah.
And in the middle of the whole thing, what should they come up against as they exposed the mountain? Inside the mountain, here was a baleen whale, 80 feet long, standing upright on its tail, covered by a mountain. Now, whatever did this was so powerful, it buried the thing before it could even fall over and just covered the whole thing and put it there.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Now, when we see these evidences, George, to me it's like showing us. Now, if we go down to Egypt today, we see the pyramids, we see the great statues, we see the Sphinx and so on, and what we are looking at is evidence, forensic evidence maybe, of a wonderful nation of the past. If we go to the world around us, we see evidence of the great events of the past, like the Great Flood. Forensic evidence.
Well, we're going to talk about buildings. Do you think they had large buildings? We'll chat about that when we come back, Jonathan. And, of course, we'll open up the phone lines. Now it's your turn to talk with Jonathan Gray. What a fascinating subject. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Find out more about tonight's guest. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.